Welcome to Slug's bi-weekly Slug Soundwaves podcast. Here, in our print mag and on slugmag.com, enjoy our curated content that highlights the best of Utah's alternative and underrepresented music, arts, events, and community subcultures. If Slug has benefited you or someone you love, consider contributing to sustain our existence. Head to slugmag.com/donate to join our community of donors.
KRCL was founded in 1979 to bring a more diverse voice to Salt Lake City and surrounding areas. KRCL is community funded and supported, which allows diverse commercial free programming that varies from indie to hip hop, blues to bluegrass, metal, punk, indigenous, and bilingual programs. Every weekday at 6 p.m., KRCL's Radioactive brings you grassroots activism and civic engagement with punk rock farming and live local music on Fridays. Tune in to KRCL at 90.9 FM. Stream at krcl.org or download the app on the App Store.
Are you listening? This is Slug Sound Waves, plural. Jeffrey Howard. I started playing the guitar in 1964 when I was 9 years old. I was living in Mount Vernon, Illinois with my family. And in February of 1964, I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. And the impact on everybody was incredible. It was just 3 months after the Kennedy assassination, so the whole country was in a depressed state. I was 9 years old. It was like seeing aliens to see the Beatles. And it was so uplifting and so happy and just perfectly what the country needed to lift everybody out of the doldrums from the JFK assassination. So I saw them in February of 64. That fall, I went to my Cub Scout Halloween party, and 50 or 60% of the kids were dressed up as the Beatles. That was the kind of impact they had. I got my first guitar by Thanksgiving. I was playing guitar by Thanksgiving 64. I played my first paying gig in 1969 at my high school. By then I had moved to Springfield, Illinois, Abe Lincoln's hometown. And I was just obsessed with rock music and playing the guitar. And so I played my first paying gig in 1969. We're now in 2026. I've played about 3,000 shows since, myself personally. I started bands in high school, and basically because I was too small to be much of an athlete, it was my avenue to get girls. Okay. And there was a time period there in the late 60s, early 70s, where it was actually kind of cooler to have long hair and be the leader of a rock band than it was to be the quarterback on the football team. It didn't last long, but I got lucky with my timing. So then I went on. I went to college in Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio for 2 years. And then a girlfriend had dumped me in Illinois, and she had come out to Utah and discovered Utah and fell in love with Utah, and she enrolled at the university. And then she changed her mind and said I could come be your boyfriend again. So I left that night in the car just driving out here. I had no idea what Utah was about, or I was just in love with this girl. And I got here and people started asking me, are you LDS? I didn't even know. I thought they were dyslexic and asking me if I had done LSD, which I had. So anyway, at the U, I enrolled in 75 and went from 75 to 1979. I was the editor of the Chronicle at the daily newspaper at the university. And with a bunch of buddies at the Chronicle, we started a band called the Barney Fife Band that wound up doing pretty well, played a lot of frat parties, played the bars, played Dead Goat. There was a bar called O.D. McGee's. We played quite a bit. We wound up opening for the Ramones in 1979 at a venue on State Street, I guess you're saying, where the Sears building was. The venue was called Abbey Road. It was about a 1,000-seater. And then through my work at the Chronicle at the university, through a bunch of circumstances, I got a job at Rolling Stone in New York, in Manhattan. So it's from 79 through 82, I lived in New York, and I moved the whole Barney Fife band out to New York. And we got our butts kicked, really, really. You know, I mean, the first place we lived was on the Jersey Shore down in Bruce Springsteen land, and the bands there were incredible. We were no longer in Kansas or Utah anymore. And we learned so much on the East Coast. And then we moved into New York and wound up playing a lot of great venues like Gertie's Folk City, where Dylan got discovered. And I learned a lot. I didn't really like Rolling Stone that much. It was corporate. You know, you'd have Mick Jagger walking by or Joe Jackson or whoever, but you still were just a guy in a cubicle. You know what I mean? Just cranking out the... And I didn't like Jan Wenner, the publisher, at all. I liked most of the people there, but I did not like Jan, and he didn't like me. So I lasted 3 years, and by then the Barney Fife band had kind of disintegrated, so I was still with one woman that was in the band, Betsy Connor, and she and I decided to move to back here to Park City. So in 1982, we moved back to Park City and started a band called Dr. Bob. And that's 44 years ago, and Dr. Bob is still playing today. In fact, we're playing our 44th anniversary concert in a couple of weeks up in Park City. And anybody's welcome to come up. It's at Prospector Park in Park City, Saturday, July 25th, the day after Pie and Beer Day. And it's 5 to 8 p.m., Prospector Park. Everybody's welcome. So we're playing our 44th anniversary concert after I've kept Dr. Bob going for 44 years. We've got 11 albums. We've got a website. I just wrote a book called DIY Rockstar that's available on Amazon. And I basically destroyed my whole life to be the leader of a garage band, and I have zero regrets. You know, I live for my art, I live for my music, but like most starving artists, I can't make a living at it. So for the last 44 years, I've worked as a day laborer. I'm a construction worker, a painter, I'll shovel your snow, mow your lawn, whatever. And I have no regrets. I mean, people say, how did you walk out of Rolling Stone? That was a dream job. It's like, it wasn't my dream. And I knew I wanted to play music and not write about music. And, you know, I just didn't want to be a writer. I didn't want the sedentary lifestyle, being chained to a keyboard all day long. And I'm so glad I made the decision when I was that young to do what I really wanted to do. But you make so many sacrifices to follow your dream and follow your heart. I never got married, never had kids. My father wouldn't speak to me for the last 30 years of my life because I wouldn't quit doing it. And you just can't listen to other people. You have to listen to yourself. You have to listen to what is best for you. But the sacrifices are huge if you're going to be an artist. They're huge. So in a nutshell, that's my story.
On black train, on which I ride.
My music, back again to in 64 when I started, my inspiration, my music, because I'm an old boomer, I'm 71 years old, was classic rock. And I'm not talking about Motley Crue in the 80s. I'm talking about 65 through about 72. My 7 all-time favorite artists that influenced me the most: the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Who, Led Zeppelin, Jimmy, the Doors, and Dylan. And I've got about 100 women tied for number 8, Janis and Chrissy Hynde. But those are my top people. But the turning point for me was when I was 12 years old in 1967. I went to the Illinois State Fair in Springfield, Illinois, where I lived. I mean, I knew what I was going to see, but just by chance, The Who opened for a band called The Association, and The Who were unknown. They had just played the Monterey Pop Festival a few weeks earlier in 67. It was when Jimi Hendrix and The Who made their first appearance in the U.S. And The Who were out of their mind. They were on amphetamines, and they were trying really hard to make it. And they were considered kind of a crazy, nutty novelty act because every show they would destroy all their equipment. And they were, when I saw them, they were $250,000 in debt because of it. And they opened, they did a 40-minute show. I was in the fourth row. Townsend destroyed his guitar. The girl next to me got a big chunk of the guitar. At the end of the 40-minute concert, all the equipment on the stage was destroyed. I was 12 years old. I was 15 feet away from it. And it ruined my life because I knew that I had to be part of that world. And ever since then, I've been a real destructive, active showman on stage. I call it the curse of Pete Townshend. And it was the most incredible concert I've ever seen in my life. I was 12 years old, completely sober, and I can still picture it. The microphones flying over my head, Keith Moon destroying his drum kit, Townshend incredible, jumping like an NBA power forward, windmills, scraping the guitar on the mic stands, constant motion. It was the most incredible concert I've ever seen, and I've seen hundreds. And I've never seen anything better than The Who in 1967. And they were unknown. The next night, they played a bowling alley in Chicago. The night after that, they played Flint, Michigan, and it was Keith Moon's birthday. And he destroyed the whole hotel. I mean, and they didn't have any money. They were out there, I don't know where they got the equipment every night to reset up the stage. I mean, they were destroying everything, and they were probably getting $3,000 or $4,000 to open for the association. Anyway, that was the turning point for me. It was 67, seeing The Who. It was a summer of love, and it was an incredible time. It was an incredible moment. The Vietnam War was raging, and the music was so important to the society. The hippies had just started, and it's something that's, I say it ruined my life. In my book, I talk about the day that ruined my life. I couldn't recover from it. I tried to straighten out. I tried to be normal. It's, you know, and I my parents wanted me to go to law school, and I was here at the U. You know, I was a very good student. I was the editor of the Chronicle at the U, but I was just kidding everybody because I knew I was never going to straighten out. And then I got the job at Rolling Stone, and people thought, oh, you know, he'll go there and make a bunch of money. But rock journalism doesn't pay that much. And I couldn't shake it after 3 years. I mean, it was a beautiful situation at Rolling Stone, but I wasn't happy. And the minute Betsy Conner and I moved back to Park City and started the band, I've been poor, I've been broke ever since. I've ruined so many relationships over it, but I have no regrets. And I, as far as the music, I was always happy. And I've written hundreds of songs, and you know, in a backwater like Utah, you kind of do it for your own enjoyment, really. You know what I mean? In the 80s and 90s, when our band was really raging up in Park City, Dr. Bob, our band, at least then you had the hope a record company might come in and sign you. And the scene in Park City in the 80s and 90s, it was connected to Salt Lake, to incredible music scene, both in Salt Lake and in Park City. So many great bands down here. At our 44th anniversary in a couple of weeks, we're playing with Tony Corologos, who was a drummer in the Gamma Rays. They were like the top punk band. Anyway, the scene we had was similar to like Seattle before Nirvana came out, or Athens, Georgia before REM came out. If somebody would have gotten signed either in Salt Lake or Park City back in the 80s and 90s, the whole scene would have exploded. It just, we were kind of a backwater, and some bands came close, but there were so many great bands down here in Salt Lake. Boxcar Kids, the Bel Airs, Gamma Rays, 004, and the bands interacted with each other. Park City, because Park City hadn't been taken over by rich people yet, it was still just blighted old miner shacks. All the musicians and bartenders lived right in Park City, so there was an artistic community that supported each other. Now nobody can afford to live in Park City. But back then, people, after you get drunk out of your mind at the gig. You'd walk home, no DUI problem, because you live right down the street. And it was this incredible, organic music scene. Like I said, it was connected to Salt Lake. Provo and Orem weren't involved. I know they've come a long way in recent years, but in the 80s and 90s, it was Salt Lake City and it was Park City. So many great bands in Park City, Fat Paw, 10th Mountain, the list go on. And it was a wonderful time. When you're in the middle of it, you don't realize you're living in paradise. And now, where the Utah music scene is, it's just a lot different. You know, and plus, the DJs have taken over now. You know, I mean, there's no bands that can play music that connects all the generations. Music's become so fragmented now. It's so hard for a live band to connect with, you know, 60-year-olds and 20-year-olds at the same time. But back then, it all worked. It was an incredible moment in Utah history. It was the music scene in the 80s and 90s. Incredible. And so many great musicians. So anyway, that's the last 25 years in Utah, I kind of call the Dark Ages. I mean, Park City got destroyed about the time of the Olympics. And then the elites moved in. Now they can work anywhere they want on the internet. They priced everybody out of Park City. They're wonderful people. But there's no organic, authentic energy anymore. There's no local musicians. It's all just kind of a... Main Street is kind of a tourist trap for rich people now up there. They bring in road bands. And in the winter, it rocks during the ski season. But there's just nothing local left. You know what I mean? It's not really authentic anymore. But Utah had a moment for about 20 years that was incredible. And I'm sure there's still great bands. I'm not connected anymore. I don't know what it's like down here now. But when the Barney Five Band opened for the Ramones in 79, it was a magic moment. We got pelted with beers on stage. And the Ramones were so unhappy to be there. The Ramones didn't want to be the Ramones. They wanted to be like Foreigner or somebody. They wanted to be playing stadiums instead of being the Ramones, the coolest band in the history of the world, right? And so backstage, they were just all bummed. It was a January night, and it was cold, and, you know, it was a 1,000-seater, which to us was a thrill. To them, it was like, you know, it was a downer. But they were awesome. It was one of the best concerts I've ever seen. They were incredible. And when I lived in New York from 79 through 82, when I was an editor at Rolling Stone, I lived right down the street from CBGB's, where they came out of. And that was an incredible moment, too. CBGB's was the biggest crap hole you've ever seen in your life. Blondie came out of there, the Ramones, Talking Heads. The bathroom was so gross, you wouldn't send your dog in there. It was like an open, there weren't even urinals at CBGB's. It was just a ditch. And you'd go and urinate in this hole and come back out, and the Ramones or Blondie would be playing. Then out front, there'd be stretch limos for like two blocks lined up. Rich, you know, and that's what Utah's missing now. As we brought the elites in here, Park City's really done this. Don't offend the rich people. The rich people want to be offended. I saw it in New York. They want a slum. They want to go out and they want Johnny Rotten to spit on them. You know what I mean? And we don't get it here. I'm not saying Salt Lake, because I'm sure Salt Lake has a hip scene. But Park City anymore, it's just like they've completely lost what people want, which is freedom. You know, that's what rock and roll is. It's rebellion. It's going against the man. You know what I mean? And we at least where I live in Park City, none of that's left. I don't know if it's still down here or not. I don't know. But anyway, I have no regrets about having left New York and left Rolling Stone, and I love Utah. I mean, I criticize aspects of the artistic scene. It's been a great place for me, the freedom to write music, and it just can't make a living on it, you know what I mean? So I wind up mowing yards and shoveling snow, but I still have no regrets. I used to have my office at Rolling Stone was on the 25th floor, overlooking the southeast corner of Central Park. The Plaza Hotel was right across the street. We were at 59th Street in Fifth Avenue. Donald Trump was right up the street, and I just hated it. When you're in the middle of it, yeah, New York was incredible. I mean, it was just incredible. And I was at Rolling Stone every day, so I mean, I was surrounded by a whole bunch of short rock stars like Eric Clapton and Mick Jagger. That were, they weren't athletes either. And it was, but you just don't realize what you're in the middle of until you get the perspective of looking back at it, you know. But New York was incredible. It was just the buskers out on the street. I mean, every corner there was energy. We used to hang out by NYU down at Union Square and score our nickel bags of pot and get stoned and sit there and watch incredible musicians out on the street. And then, you know, the bar scene was incredible. I mean, it was just, the energy was incredible. It was great. I feel so lucky I was there for 3 years, because when I was at the U and thought I was in a rock band, I didn't know what a rock band was until I went to the East Coast and got my butt kicked. Those people rock. It's like, you know, somebody coming here from Kansas and think they're going to ski in Park City. It's like, no, you're going to be around people who have skied since they're 3 years old. We were around people in Jersey that had been in bands since they were like 4 feet tall. And I needed that to give me a perspective to bring it back to Utah. And I've been, I can be difficult to deal with because I learned my trade in New York. And I saw what it's all about. If you want to be nice to me, you'll have no problem. If you want to be a butthole, you've come to the right place. Okay? I mean, it's like, that's just what I learned in New York. You got to toughen up or else go home. You can either cry or... The first gig we played, Betsy Connor, my partner, we played a bar in New Jersey. And we got our butts kicked by a road band called Bystander. Terrible name, but they were awesome. And that was our first gig on the East Coast, and she and I went outside. And fortunately, she waited till she got outside to start crying like a baby. And we were like, are we going to go back to Utah? Are we going to go back one gig after we got our asses kicked? Are we go back to Utah, where we were heroes? We didn't. We stayed, but it's hard. I mean, if you're going to do it, you've got to be ready. You've got to be psychologically ready, because the industry is set up there to discourage you. You've got to prove it to people. You've got to prove that who are you? You're nobody. You think you're a rock star? You're nobody. And so anyway, the 3 years I did in New York, I brought back to Utah, and I've done 44 years now. And there's bodies behind me laying on the side of the road. You know, and sometimes people say you're a jerk. You're a butthole. It's like... It's hard to explain, but if you're going to live for rock and roll music, you're going to have to be that way. You can be nice when it's appropriate, but you got to be tough. You've got to. It's a war zone on those stages. You know what I mean? You've got to be ready, and you've got to be, like I said, when we opened for the Ramones here in Salt Lake in '79, we got pelted with beers. I mean, we were just drenched with beers by the time our set was over. And then I moved to New York. So it started here. I got my lessons started here. But what are you going to do? You got to, why are they throwing beers at us? We better change something. So, you know what I mean? We don't get beers thrown at us anymore. So something worked out. I believe in the power of rock and roll, and I still believe rock and roll could save this planet, but people have to live it. I mean, a lot of artists I don't like Axl Rose, I don't like him, but I respect the fact that he's obviously a total diva. Jim Morrison's another person that really affected my life. And I would not have wanted to known Jim Morrison because he was a total asshole in person. You wouldn't want to hang around him. You know what I mean? But from a distance, the guy was a real deal. He got arrested twice on stage. That's a record that'll probably stand forever. You know, whether he exposed his penis or not, I don't know. I haven't seen any pictures, and I read the transcripts when I was a Rolling Stone. But he might as well have exposed his penis because it got his band totally blackballed in the United States. That's why he moved to Paris and he died in Paris. They were not allowed to play anywhere by the time they were done. That's the real deal. By the end of your career, you should not be allowed to play in any venue anywhere if you really did a good job. I've written so many, and it's over a 50-year period, so it's a large conglomeration, and people can hear the music at our website, Dr. Bob JDH. I will say this, because I was in Utah and really had no hope of ever making it or getting a record contract, all of my songs are real because I wrote them for my own entertainment. But there's no overriding theme or anything. It's just anger. But, you know, I can be happy. You know, I mean, there's fun things. Rock and roll should be fun also. But our second album was called Beer for Breakfast, and we weren't joking. So it's whatever your lifestyle is, that's what you're trying to put in your music. You're trying to be real. And the where people get lost is they try to follow trends or write songs to make them famous or make it. That's why I got out of New York. When I was in New York, I was trying to copy trends. New wave was the trend right then. It was post-punk new wave. And I was writing a bunch of crap because I was trying to get, you know, some A&R guy to label to listen to this. And it's like, it was a bunch of crap. You gotta write what you really believe about. So every song I've written, I stand behind, and it's something I believe in. And the music is based on, like I said, my top seven artists: Beatles, Rolling Stones, Who, Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, The Doors, and Bob Dylan, and a bunch of women on number eight. So, I mean, that's the music is based on that music. And my lyrics are based on the writers I really appreciate. Dylan at his best, nobody can touch him. At his worst, he should be in that latrine at CBGB's. The crap he puts out. Why can't somebody tell him no? You know, they put out so many shiny turds. Bruce Springsteen's the same way. If I wrote 500 songs, I'd get five good ones. You know what I mean? So, I mean, you can't follow trends. You can't try to do it just to make money. That's what ruins everything. The money always ruins everything. Baby, cry. Where were you the night John Lennon died? So I know how to write because I was an editor at Rolling Stone, but I hadn't written anything in 40 years, and I had some good stories to tell. There's a chapter in there about when I spent 8 hours with Hunter Thompson on the University of Utah campus. He flew in to speak, and my buddy in the Barney Fife band, he's on the cover of the book there, we were working at the Chronicle, and we got a call about 11 a.m. that morning that they brought in Hunter Thompson to speak at the law school, and then he was going to speak in the Union Ballroom up at the U. And the law school was sponsoring bringing Hunter in. It was about 1977 or 78. He was a rock star. Everybody knew him. You know, he'd written Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And we were at the Chronicle office about 11 a.m. We got the call from the law school, like the guy that was supposed to pick him up at the airport couldn't make it. So my buddy and I, Sam Walker, we didn't ask any questions. Like, Hunter Thompson's waiting at the airport? We're there. So we picked him up about 1 p.m. at the airport. And I think his first scheduled appearance was the law school about 5 p.m. And he was the real deal. I mean, he wanted booze. He wanted ganja. later on, one of the law students gave him a bunch of cocaine. I didn't supply him cocaine. So we spent about 8 hours with Hunter. I wound up on stage with him. So did Sam. We took over his, like, his side. He showed up at the airport with no baggage. I think he was tripping. He was pulling cat hairs off his tongue because he'd spent the night before at John Belushi's apartment on the couch, and the cat was all over him. And he was kind of incoherent, but he was still a lot of fun. So we wound up, we had bad marijuana. So we smoked all that. We went to the liquor store. We got him Wild Turkey. Sam got a fifth of Yukon Jack. And we knew the taxi driver. And Hunter wanted ganja. He wanted better quality marijuana. So the taxi driver knew somebody in Sandy. So we took a big detour down to Sandy to score. We got some Hawaiian and we got some hash for Hunter. And he didn't seem to be concerned about what he was even there for. He never asked, like, where are we going or anything. So we had this great long trip with him. We had a bong in the back seat. It was an old yellow cab. And Sam and Hunter and I sat there, and the cab driver, we knew him. We drove around for about 3 or 4 hours. And we showed up at the law school about 40 minutes late, and they weren't happy. And so by then, Sam and I realized nobody there knew who we were, so we started acting like we were his handlers from New York. Like, clear the way. Dr. Thompson coming through, right? So at the law school, he goes in the bathroom, and a law student who's still famous today and is practicing in Salt Lake, so I don't want to mention his name, he came in with a vial, about a gram and a half of cocaine, and handed it to Hunter. And Hunter went in the stall, and 3 or 4 minutes later, he came back out and handed it to him. It was empty, which means he either did a gram and a half in there, or else he stashed some for later. So then he went out and did his show at the law school. But I announced for him, he wasn't going to give a speech. He was only going to answer questions. That completely violated his contract. He also had an open liquor container. We'd gone to D's, and he had a big 32-ounce thing with ice and Wild Turkey he was carrying with him everywhere he went on campus. So that was in violation of Utah open container law. So we got him through the show at the law school, and he was pretty funny. If you've ever seen him on Letterman or any of the late-night talk shows, he's kind of hard to understand. He mumbles a lot. But people loved him. He was Hunter being Hunter. So we got him through that show. By then, we were almost an hour late. We had to get him up the hill to the Union Building at the university for his second show. So we're walking up the hill, and he was just out of his mind in a way, but I mean, he's still in control. So Sam and he decide they're going to go in the bottom of the open student union building. They told me, we're going in the bathroom. He seemed like he always wanted to go in the men's room, because I think that's where he was doing drugs. And he had a satchel with him, which I don't know what was in that. So I said, I'm going to go upstairs and try to get this crowd calmed down, because there was a full house up in the ballroom at the student union building. And they weren't happy. It was at least an hour late by the time I got up there. So I went up on the stage, and Dr. Thompson's in the building. We're going to be with you quick, you know, very shortly. Well, unbeknownst to me, downstairs, Sam Walker, my friend, and Hunter Thompson were destroying the men's room. They ripped anything, broken mirrors, smashed toilets. When they finally showed up on stage, Sam was carrying a soap dispenser from the bathroom downstairs. But eventually they did make it upstairs. They did several thousand dollars worth of damage in the men's room before he got up on stage. And that was another reason he was never paid, because he wouldn't give a speech. He had open containers, and he destroyed the men's room at the student union building. But then he got through the show, and I was with him for 8 hours, and I really don't remember one coherent thing he said. But he was one of the best human beings I've ever been around. Anyway, the book is because I had a bunch of good stories. And if you wait till you're 70 years old to write a book, you've got all your good stories. And the other great thing is, the witnesses to your stories are either dead or have dementia, so you can tell your stories any way you want. Nobody can contradict you. So that's why I wrote the book. And I'm still looking to make some money. And I've got a second book ready to go about Park City. But I'm not going to write a second book for free, because when you write a book for Amazon, you give it away to them just to get the book out. And I'm not going to write a second book for Amazon. So I've got a second book ready to go about Park City. But the reason I wrote the book is the stories about the Who and about Hunter Thompson. And, you know, I've lived an interesting life to some extent. So I wrote the book, like everybody, to make money, and it hasn't worked out. I hear the tick, tick, tick of the clock on the wall. I hear the tick, tick, tick of the clock on the wall. I see the big head going round just the same as a small. I hear the tick, tick, tick of the clock on the wall. In the 80s and 90s, they called it the Barmuda Triangle. It was right in the middle of historic Main Street in Park City. The main bar was called the Alamo, which is now called the No Name Bar. Dr. Bob played there about 350 times in the 80s and 90s. There was a bar up the street called Cicero's. We played there about 200 times. And then there were all these satellite bars up and down the street. Now the buildings are all still there, but they're just full of DJs, and there's just nothing similar. The buildings are still the same. I miss everything about Park City in the 80s and 90s, and particularly the venues. There was total freedom. It was incredible. And there were great venues down here. We toured, and we used to come down here, Bar and Grill, Port-A-Call, Green Parrot, Green Street. There were great places down here, but Park City had something special going. There were no adults in the room for about 20 years, and it was awesome. And it's not there anymore. Yeah, I miss a lot about it. But I still make music, and I still really enjoy it. And like I said, we're playing a 44th anniversary concert, July 25th, Saturday. It's in Prospector Park in Park City. And your audience is welcome to show up 5 to 8 p.m. So they can come up and see. And the Gamma Rays drummer, Tony Corologos, will be playing with us. And it'll be a little taste of what we're doing. Right brain pays the bills while the left brain does the spending. That's why I get confused with all the messages they're sending. Rules that can't be broken are the ones they make forbidden. Right brain pays the bills while the left brain does the spending. I hear the tick, tick, tick of the clock on the wall. The song I would recommend for our purposes here would be a song called Got That Going For Me, which I think we stole that from Bill Murray. He might have said that. And it's about the bar scene. It's a short song, but it's about how it's more important to have your friends and the social scene as opposed to being rich. It's about real life versus greed and materialism, which has basically ruined everything in the world. The song is called Got That Going For Me. It's about 3 minutes long. That'd be the one I'd recommend. It's on YouTube or it's at our website.
Cool.
And it features Betsy Connor. She deserves so much credit for the Dr. Bob Band. And she's up in Portland now. She has two bands of her own. And she is killing it in Portland. Betsy Connor Pott is her name now, and she was so much a part of the Park City bar scene. I mean, she was a bartender besides being in the band, and she's probably the best thing that ever came out of Park City.
Rather have
play guitar with a lot of soul, but my equipment's kind of cruddy.
Got that going for me.
I hit my amp on top to make it work. Sometimes it still sounds funky.
Got that going for me.
I turn the buttons up, I turn the buttons down. It still sounds muddy.
Got that going for me.
But all my friends just say you sounded great. All my friends adore me.
Website is Dr. Bob JDH, my three initials, Jeffrey Dwayne Howery. So it's drbobjdh.com. We also have a YouTube channel called the Dr. Bob Band. And I'm recommending people go on Amazon and buy my book, DIY Rockstar.
This episode was produced and edited by me, Nate McQuivey, and promoted by the Slug Magazine editorial staff. Be sure to check out this month's issue of Slug. You can find a copy anyplace cool or at slugmag.com.
Did you enjoy this episode of Slug Soundwaves? You and the local community can continue to enjoy Slug Mag's content for free, but please consider making a one-time or ongoing contribution. Each contribution, no matter the amount, helps support Slug's creation of thoughtful media coverage on SLC's music, arts, events, and community subcultures. Head over to slugmag.com/donate to make your contribution today.